Just before we start, also just a couple of announcements. First of all, just say the date again. As I mentioned last week, on Friday, the 1st of December, we're going to do another mindful minyan here, where we're going to combine it, because it's summertime, we can do this. We're going to combine it with a special candle lighting experience. Also, I wanted to mention that next week, I will send an email out, but next week, we're going to take a break. I'm going to be overseas. There's the yearly convention that I try to go to. So that's next week, so I won't be here. So one of a class, so we'll resume again in 2 weeks' time for a few weeks just to end the series. Okay, so just a little bit of a review. We've been working through the letter of Nachmanides, 13th century, the 10 steps of personal, or 11 steps actually, that we've turned it into 10 steps, that he writes to his son from Israel to Spain, urging him to engage in all the aspects of personal growth that he mentions there. And just to recap so far, we've talked about how he opens the letter with an urge, urging him to be open, to listen, to absorb the teachings. The second step he talked about a lot was the concept of calmness, speaking calmly and creating a sense of calm, a sense of inner calm. And then last week, we'll just review a bit, he spoke about anger. He spoke about anger being the root of evil, anger needing strength to overcome, yet emphasizing that it's possible, we can be in control, but it takes a tremendous inner strength. And he explained that, we went through and developed last week, that some of the reasons that anger or losing one's temper is so negative is that, first of all, it's ineffective because it shifts any conversation from content to being personal. So no conflict or no issue can be resolved through anger, because once anger sets in, it's a personal thing rather than sticking to the ideas and the content that we need to resolve. The second thing is that it's loss of control, which is a terrible thing. A person always has to be in control. That's the essence of the human being, where the head rules the heart. We also talked about what the Talmud says, that anger is like a Vodah Zarah, idol worship, and the reason was because when we keep getting upset about things that happen to us, subtly it's a denial of the fact that everything has a bigger plan, everything has Hashem's, God's control, and that arrogance of expecting everything to be under our control and working out the way we wanted it to work out, obviously is in contradiction to that concept. And we also said that, of course, anger is ineffective because it creates unhappiness for ourselves. It's bad for ourselves, bad for the person that gets angry. It just creates a constant state of unhappiness. As I said last week, I've never met an angry person that's happy. In other words, it just removes that ability to have an inner sense of meaning and purpose and fulfillment and contentment. So last week we also run through it very quickly again. We talked about the strategies in managing anger, and the strategy is divided into two. The first thing is there has to be a mindset. And that's the mindset we talked about last week, that the building up in our mind, that concept that God runs the world, that everything does have a plan, that things are meant for a purpose, that we can't control what happens to us, but we control how we respond. Sometimes you can use it as an opportunity to make us a stronger person, and so on and so forth. Then, of course, there's a whole bunch of practical strategies, which we talked about last week. We'll just run through them very quickly. Number one was the ability to identify triggers, choosing a strategy that works, reviewing our strategy the whole time. We talked a lot about thinking before we speak. That's a hard thing to do, but that ability to always pause and think before we say something, including emails, WhatsApps, and so on and so forth. The next one was a really important one, the idea of learning to communicate effectively. In other words, often we get angry because we actually don't know how to express what we want to say assertively, but with consideration and respect and dignity, so we do it in a frustrated way. Taking time off, sharpening the saw, learning to relax, the 10-second rule, lack of communication diffuses emotion, therefore sometimes just to be quiet when our buttons are pushed for 10 seconds and then hopefully it'll diffuse, to know when we need help and to share with others. So those are some of the strategies that we went through last week in managing anger. Now, towards the end of last week's session, I want to just mention this because I'm going to come back to it soon, but an interesting point was raised. And the comment was that sometimes people engage in anger or lose their temper or are angry on an ongoing basis, being ignited from past baggage, from stuff that's been there for a long time. might be trauma, it might be childhood stuff, it might be things that have happened in the past, negative experiences, negative relationships, lack of self-esteem, and so on and so forth. So the concept was that perhaps also we need to talk about dealing with some of those issues before we can manage our anger. In other words, before we need to get to the root cause sometimes of what is it that's triggering all this negativity within us and this lack of inner calm and this conflict and tension and frustration and so on, in order to really be able to apply the strategies properly to manage the anger. Now, there was a really important point, and I said I would talk about it today, which I'm going to, but I'm just going to put it on hold because I want to talk about the next part of the letter and then bring it back to this idea as well. Okay. So let's move on to the next step. What we're going to do now is talk about the next two things that Nachmanides says in his letter. We're going to just read it through, first of all, and then try and develop it. So the next part of the letter, Nachmanides says the following. He says, once you have distanced yourself from anger, the quality of humility will enter your heart. And he said, humility, the sterling quality, is the finest of all admirable traits. Interesting comment. Nachmanides says, humility is the most admirable of all, the most important of all admirable traits. That's point one. The next point he makes, he says, and we're going to develop it, and by the end we'll understand what this means, hopefully. He says, on the heels of humility comes the Yirat Hashem, which he refers to as fear of God. In other words, the ability to surrender to God, to have a relationship with God, to follow in God's values, is a direct outcome of humility. Okay. So before we get to the last part, let's develop the first part of this paragraph, which is revisiting and trying to understand once again the concept of humility. As we've said many, many times, just to define what humility is, right? Humility is, let's just talk about what, first of all, what humility is not. Humility is not a sense of nothingness, right? It's not a sense of lowliness. On the contrary, what nothingness or lowliness will lead to is insecurity, and insecurity is the other side of the coin of arrogance. In other words, insecurity and arrogance, as we'll see and will develop, is actually really subtly the same thing, just expressed in different ways. A sense of lowliness and a sense of nothingness doesn't lead a person to leading a productive life, doesn't lead a person to leading a life of value and meaning. On the contrary, what lowliness and nothingness leads to is dysfunction. Abdication of responsibility. Not doing what we can do. Not realizing our potential. So humility is certainly not a feeling of nothingness and lowliness. So what is it? Essentially, this is the summary. The essence of humility is, and let's develop what this means, but the essence of humility is that it's not about me. I know what I am. I don't have a feeling of nothingness and loneliness, but it's not about me. It's not about me being superior to anyone else or anything else. And because of that, the humble person, I think this is one of the key and most important parts of humility, is that the humble person is able to make space for other people and other things. Whereas the arrogant person cannot do that. So let's just develop this a bit. We've touched on it before, but I want to just try and expand on it a bit today. So we understand that a person who's truly humble is a person, number one, who recognizes their own talents, recognizes their achievements, recognizes what they're capable of and what they have achieved. In other words, talents and achievements, right? It's not healthy to be in denial. It's not healthy not to know who we are. And as I've said many, many times in the concept when we talked about the idea of Cheshbon HaNefesh, where the literature talks about the idea of self-reckoning and self-reflection as a preparation for improvement, that self-audit that we do for ourselves always has to include two lists. We have to know our weaknesses and we have to know our strengths. Knowing our strengths means we have to know what we're capable of, what our talents are, what our capabilities are, and we have to know what we've already achieved. We have to know what we have done in the area of growth, right? However, the humble person, knowing their own talents and knowing their own achievements, the humble individual doesn't take credit for them. Because first and foremost, from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective, the humble person first and foremost knows that his or her blessings and achievements and talents are God-given. Our talents are opportunities that God gives us, strength that God gives us, that God, who is the creator not only of me but the entire world, has given each and every one of us a set of strengths and a set of missions and a set of values and a set of opportunities. And therefore, no matter how popular and gifted we might be, it doesn't go to the head because it's not about us. Now, of course, the classic example, as we've said many times, is Moses. Moses, who the Torah testifies about Moses, that he was the most humble of all men. Now imagine this, you know who wrote the Torah? I mean, it's God's words, but God dictated it. Who did he dictate it to? To Moses, right? So imagine Moses writing. Moses was the most humble, or is the most humble of all people, right? But I'll tell you more than that. Moses didn't only write that. He also wrote some of the last verses of the Chumash, where it says, "V'lo kam b'Yisrael Navi," that there was no prophet that ever arose like Moses. Moses wrote in the Chumash, dictated by God, that he was the leader of Am Yisrael, leader of Jewish people, who argued with God about becoming the leader of the Jewish nation, but at the same time was the one to take them out, to lead them for 40 years. Most amazing individual, and he was very conscious of it. There's no way that he could escape that realization and that acknowledgement. Yet, as the sources tell us, he was, in fact, the most humble of all people, because he never took credit for it. He understood that all that he has and all the ability that he has was because of the gifts that God has given him. And in fact, the sources tell us, right, that Moses felt, this was part of his humility, that had someone else been given the same set of opportunities, maybe they'd do better than him. So it wasn't that he didn't know what he had done. He had a sense of accomplishment, I assume, but he didn't take the credit. He felt humble, and he didn't have any sense of being superior to other people, because his strengths and someone else's strengths, his challenges and someone else's challenges, are all part of God's plan and God's gift. So that's a true humble person. Now let's take that one step further. Not only is that the trait of a humble person, but in fact, that is the only way a person can achieve humility. Why? When it's interesting that this is a thought I saw just recently in an article by Rabbi Tauber. He says the following, that it's interesting, as time develops, as time progresses, we should look at ourselves as being more insignificant. You know, in ancient times, people thought the world was very small. There was no communication. There was no understanding, perhaps, of the greater universe and the greater galaxy and so on and so forth. So people felt, you know, I'm part of like a few hundred thousand people, little world. So they must have taken up a lot of space. With time, as time progresses, we get to the realization that we're just a speck in a huge cosmos, right? And yet that hasn't achieved any less ego. In fact, on the contrary, we live today in an incredibly I world, right? iPhone, iTouch, right? No, that's what they say, right? It's about, everything's about I today. It's a very, very me world, a very I world. Why is that? Because feeling of insignificance actually doesn't bring humility. Feeling of insignificance can actually result in the biggest ego. Why? You see, when we understand the greatness of the world, the more we should realize, yes, we are, in comparison to the rest of existence, quite insignificant. But that means we're part of an amazing existence. Who created this tremendous existence? The greater the existence is, the greater our realization for the greatness of God should become. And the greater we should realize, and this is the important point, that this amazing plan includes me. In other words, notwithstanding that God created not just a few hundred thousand people, but that God created like an infinite cosmos with an amazing universe with so many millions of people, millions of plants. I mean, they now know today, if you Google, as one does for any information, you'll see the incredible list of how many animals there are in the world, how many plants there are in the world, right? Now, if that's just an accident, so then it's not relevant to me. But if it's a divine plan, and notwithstanding this tremendous cosmos that God created, He still created me. Why did He create me? Because I matter. What does it mean I matter? Not I matter in an egocentric way, that I am better than the rest of the world. I'm not. I'm just a speck in the huge plan. But obviously this speck matters. And this speck has a mission to play. And this speck has a role to play. And this speck, this insignificant little dot, has to be responsible. And doesn't have the luxury of deciding that I'm just nothing. Does that make sense? In other words, insignificance. When I say I'm nothing, when I say I'm just a speck, an accidental speck in the big cosmos, in other words, it's all about me. I'm just abdicating responsibility. It's another manifestation and a mother expression of ego. When I put myself down, I'm running away from myself. That's just another way of pandering to myself. That's another way of giving into myself. Arrogance and nothingness are the same thing. It's about not understanding my worth, not understanding that actually, notwithstanding that I'm just a little tiny dot, but I'm a tiny dot part of an infinite plan, part of God's reality, who created me because I matter, because I have a role to play, because what I do today is important, because what I do today no one else can do. Not that I'm superior, because I'm just a nothing, really. But that nothing is important. But if it results in a feeling of nothingness, it's just an escape. Which is why today we find more and more the abdication of responsibility. The more and more people realize how great and vast the universe is, but don't realize how it's all part of a divine creation and a divine plan, then they just say, well, I don't matter, so I can do what I want. I'm nothing, so I can just pander to my own weakness. I don't have to take responsibility. I don't have to work hard. I don't have to put in the effort. I don't have to live a life of values and meaning. I can do whatever I want because I'm nothing. So a feeling of nothingness is just another way of saying it's all about me. However, if I understand that that nothing that I am is actually part of God's creation, He created this nothing. He created this seemingly insignificant little thing, then this little thing really matters. And if it really matters, I can't just say I'm nothing. Because if I am divinely created as small as this fraction is, but every part of this fraction is important. So I need to know, hold on a second, if God created me, so what did He create? I can't ignore His creation. If God created me, I need to know, what did He create? What strengths did He give me? What weaknesses did He give me? What weaknesses did He give me to work on? And what strengths did He give me to be able to fulfill my mission? Which is exactly what God told Moses at the burning bush. Moses, in fact, was truly humble, but God had to kind of lead, channel his humility. And God says, humility does not mean you can abdicate the responsibility. Yes, I understand you don't think you're a great person. I understand you think other people could do better than you, but you have to go and lead the Jewish people. Because that's who I need. I don't need an arrogant person. I need a humble person. But a humble person that understands who he is. A humble person who understands his achievements. And a humble person who understands his capabilities and his potential. And you have to go and use every part of what God has given you to accomplish. In other words, humility can only really come by understanding that we're part of a greater plan, that we're divinely created, which is why we become humble. Why we're not superior to other people? Because we don't take credit for ourselves. We know it's all God-given. But that very notion and that very knowledge that it's all God-given also translates in the need, in the absolute need, to say that means every part of who I am, which is God-given, is important. And I have a responsibility to make sure every part of me works and works to the best of ability without feeling any sense of arrogance and superiority of other people. But yet, I can't give up any part of me because it's part of the plan. It's what I am. It's what God gave me. And it's not about me. It's about the bigger picture. It's about the divine plan. And if it's about the divine plan, so I better use everything He gave me for that purpose. At the same time, however, if that's the source of what I'm feeling, then it also means that I can make tremendous space for others, because it's not about me. And if it's about being part of that great infinite plan created and driven by a higher being, then there's place for everyone. I'm not threatened. People don't step on my toes. I don't take myself that seriously, meaning in a negative sense. I take my gifts seriously, my opportunities seriously, because I need to work on them. But I don't take myself seriously, being always focused on myself, because I'm just an important part of a very big plan. It's like a little screw in a very complex, huge machine. The screw is missing, the machine is dysfunctional. It's just a screw, but it's incredibly important. And that's how we have to look at ourselves. So there was a great Hasidic Rebbe called Reb Simcha Bunim Apshishcha, just to bring out this idea a little bit, develop it a bit. And he talked about the two pieces of paper. This is what he used to say. Reb Simcha Bunim Apshishcha. He says, every person has to have two pieces of paper that he has to keep in his two pockets. That's what he used to say. And on each piece of paper, he should write something different. And he quoted a phrase from the Tanakh or the Talmud. He said, on one piece of paper, he should write down what Abraham said in last week's parasha, when he said to God, "I'm sorry, I'm debating you," because he didn't want God to destroy the city of Sodom. And he had the strength to almost argue with God. And he said, "I'm really sorry. I understand who I am." And he said, "Anochi afar v'efer. I'm just dust and ash. I'm nothing." That's what Abraham said. Humility. I'm nothing. That's what he should write on one piece of paper. And another piece of paper, Reb Simcha Bunim said he should write the Talmudic saying that a person should always say, listen to what the Talmud says. The Talmud says that a person should always say, "Bishvili nivra ha'olam." For me, the world was created. Right? Now, lots of people say, "For me, the world was created." It just depends what they mean. Right? In fact, some people don't even say it. You can just see it written all over their face. Just their very presence, you can see they just think they're the center of the universe, right? That's the flip side of nothingness. It's total arrogance, but it's the same disease. But of course, that's not what the Talmud means. Which is why Reb Simcha Bunim said, put both pieces of paper in either pocket, hold those both sayings together. Now, what did he mean? He didn't mean about, he wasn't talking about balance. Some people understand this, that he wanted to balance it out. Like, let's balance out. I'm nothing, but the world was created for me. No. Because if the Talmud wanted to give us a balance, they would give us one saying that has a balance. It's not about balance. It's about the two things are dependent on each other. In other words, the two things are absolutely true to the extreme, and they coexist. Because on the one piece of paper, we need to write, "We are nothing," because we are nothing. What are we? Just an insignificant speck in a huge, infinite existence. How do you feel that way? How do you get to that feeling? Only with a deep belief that we're part of a divine creation. Who's infinite? God is unlimited. He's completely infinite, and therefore he had the ability to create such an amazing, as King David said, "Marabu ma'asecha Hashem, how great, how many, how multitude is your actions, God," right? And therefore we see, we didn't make ourselves. We're just one of God's infinitely millions and millions and millions of creations. On the other hand, that very feeling has to bring me to the realization, therefore the world was created for me. In other words, I matter. I have to view myself as I wake up in the morning, that what I can accomplish today, no one can do for me. It doesn't make me superior to you. It doesn't make me threatened by you. It doesn't make me contradict what you're doing, because we're all part of this infinite plan, and this infinite plan has a lot of space. There's a lot of space. You know, they say a beautiful idea. They say that in the temple times, particularly in the first temple, there were many miracles that happened in the temple. And one of the miracles was that people would come there on Yom Kippur, particularly. There'd be thousands of Jews that would gather in the temple, and one of the things they had to do, that we sort of reenact now in the synagogue on Yom Kippur, is they had to bow down. A few times during the day when they would hear the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, saying the special name of God, they would fall on their faces, lie flat. So there was no space. So the Talmud says a very interesting thing. It says that one of the miracles that happened in the temple was Omdim Tzfufim. They would stand squashed. But Umishtachavim, when they would bow down, Revachim would be plenty of place. Miracle. So one of the Hasidic masters once translated this Talmud. He said, no, it means like this. It's a general formula for life. Omdim, when a person stands, meaning when a person is into themselves, they assert themselves in a negative way, they're egocentric, they stand their ground because it's all about them, then Sfufim, it's very squashy. There's no place for anyone else. But Mishtachavim, when we surrender a little bit, when it's not about us, when we subjugate ourselves to a higher cause, when we understand we just are part of a much greater creation, we're part of God's reality and His creation, and God Himself is infinite, and there's so much space for everyone. If Mishtachavim, when we bow down, then all of a sudden, Revachim, there's plenty of place for everyone. I can be the most talented individual in the world, but there's still plenty of place for everyone because it's infinite, right? So that's what Rav Simcha Bunim said. Rav Simcha Bunim said, hold those two pieces of paper in your pocket because they depend on each other. Understand that it's not about you. It's not about you being superior. It's not your achievements. It's God-given, and appreciate that and have gratitude for the opportunities and the talents and the strength that God has given to you. But don't abdicate responsibility. Get up in the morning and say, Bishvili Nivra Olam, the world was created for me. I have a mission to play today that no one else could do. And therefore, I better do it. I better work on it and work hard. That's how it works. And the truth is, this whole idea is actually reflected in the very genesis of the creation of the human being. I mentioned this before, but it comes out so beautifully in this concept. When Adam was created, when the first man was created, so we know that the Chumash tells us that the Adam was created very differently to the rest of creation. God created all the animals in pairs. The human being created alone, yechidi. Man, and then afterwards woman. Right? Says the Talmud, why was the person created yechidi? Why was the person created alone? To teach us that every person, every human being is an olam malay, an entire universe. Every person is as significant as an entire world. Yet three sentences later, God says, Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. What does that mean? On a deeper level, what that means is, I created the human being alone to teach him or her that every human being is an entire universe. But it's not good if that entire universe results in not making space for other people. It's not good if the result of that being created alone is aloneness. It's not good for the man to be alone. The whole purpose of creation of the human being is to make space for others. The whole purpose of the human being is to make space for a higher being, to make space for God, to have a relationship, to connect to the world around them. The whole success of that single human being, the singularity of the human being's success is only when they go out of themselves, when they connect to other people, when they learn from other people, when they learn from other things, when they connect to a higher source. That's the success of the human being. So yes, the person is a singular force that is as significant, as great as an entire universe, but only when he or she sees him or herself as part of the bigger picture. They have to go together. And that's humility. I'll share with you something that brings us out in a very personal thing. I mentioned at the beginning that yesterday was the first Yahrzeit of Dina's father, my father-in-law. A very illustrious man. I had a very special relationship with him, not because he was my father-in-law, but because I knew him before I knew my wife. He was my teacher. He was my teacher in yeshiva. So when I studied in Morristown, in New Jersey for 2.5 years, he was the dean of the college, so to speak, and he gave us shirim, and he would be the mentor, as they call it, the mentor of the yeshiva. He was like the spiritual guide of the yeshiva. In fact, I'll tell you a cute story. Nothing to do with what I'm about to say, but just a cute little story. One time there was a publication that the yeshiva would produce every week, which he would be on the chief, he would run it. He would run the editorial board, and for a short time I was part of the editorial board of that publication. And one time I was reaching a deadline, and I needed something really to get an okay from him or get advice from him. So I called his house, which we didn't normally do, but I called his house, And some girl answered, and I asked if Rabbi Tzvi was home. It was Dina, and I didn't know that. It was my wife. And apparently afterwards, she said to her father, I was told by her mother later, who is that bocher that speaks so fast? I guess when I dated, I must have slowed down a little bit. So I mentioned that only because he's an amazing, amazing, amazing person, and he's from the set of few people that actually, I could say honestly, had a very, very big impact and shaped who I am today. You know, I often mention my grandfather, but he was also one of them, and a tremendous, tremendous impact. Now I just need to explain to you who he was, because otherwise it won't do justice to the concept that I want to share with you. Because it was amazing when we were there last year when he passed away, and during the Shiva we heard all these amazing stories, and it was interesting to hear the different perspectives coming from different people. So he was a tremendous, tremendous giant in Torah knowledge. I mean, he was like one of the few. You know, whether it was Talmud or Kabbalah or Jewish law, whatever, he was well versed in everything. Every new book that would come out, he would read to cover to cover. He was an amazing, amazing genius with a tremendous, tremendous insight. And he had this towering, towering presence about him. So he would sort of come into a room and he was always present. He had this amazing, I don't know how to translate it properly in English, but in Yiddish we call it a shtel. He had this like amazing aura about him. But he also had this incredible humility, but to an extreme. And Dina and I were just talking the other day, and I sort of had this definition in my mind. I said, you know, it's interesting just by reflecting, I've never ever met someone like that who was so present and yet took up no space whatsoever. Like, took up absolutely no space. And that's an incredible combination. And that's, I think, encapsulates what I'm trying to say. I put a picture. This was him, right? He had this amazing presence about him. And he had this, like, he was very angelic. And he had this, like, he was always, I mean, everyone always deferred to him in the faculty, and the students. It was like, he was, especially as he got older, he was always like the go-to. But he took up absolutely no space. I've never met someone who never ever spoke about himself, never. He'd probably cringe if he knew that I was doing this, like, if you know what I'm saying. Like, but I'm doing it because I think we can learn something from it. He never demanded anything. He hated asking people for favors or being dependent on other people or inconveniencing other people. And you know, he came into a room, just sit quietly. Kind of, it always happened. Then he became like people gravitate there, but. He just never took up any space, and yet had this incredible, incredible presence. I don't know if he had the two papers in his pockets, but he embodied those two papers. In other words, he used to absolutely abhor talking about himself, and he was allergic to the whole concept of ego. And he had plenty to what to be egocentric about, but, I mean, in terms of talent and knowledge and accomplishments, he literally impacted upon thousands and thousands of students who went through his yeshiva from year to year. Only one time he told me, it's an interesting thing actually, it was a couple of years ago, I spent a few minutes with him at the banquet of this convention that I'm going to next week. And he hadn't come every year, but he came that year, and there's like 4,000 or 5,000 people in the room, Chabad rabbis from all over the world. And a large number of them are his students. So they were happy to see him there, you know, they're all over the world. So the whole time people kept on going over to him and said, you know, saying hello, and they were telling him he remembered some of them, some of them didn't remember them from years ago. So after I was sitting with him and traveling back, and he said to me, he said, so many people came over to me. He said, I don't know, maybe I did accomplish something. I don't know. Like, it was the only time I heard it. It was the only time I heard him say something about himself. I was like, maybe I'm a factor. I don't know. Anyway, that's the concept I'm talking about. That combination of not escaping, not using who you are, not understanding who you are, and yet not taking up space, not being the center of attention. Not focusing on yourself. You know, I saw this beautiful little sign. It says, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Right? It's a great definition. Because, right? And I think that sort of sums it up. Because we don't need to think about ourselves, because we're in good hands. Who we are is a product of God's creation. So he's with us. He created us. We're part of his reality. And therefore, there's space for other people. There's a mission for other people. We don't need to be threatened by other people. I mean, it's all easy to say, of course, and hard to do. But But it's about not taking ourselves that seriously, not in a negative way, not focusing ourselves, not overdoing and being over focused on the needs of what we need, being giving, worrying about what other people need, and yet at the same time not disappearing, being fully present, being fully aware of who we are, and taking responsibility for that and accomplishing the potential of what God gave us. Which now goes back to the letter of Nachmanides. So let's carefully understand what Nachmanides says in his letter. He writes to his son to talk calmly and to banish anger. He says anger and temper is the root of all evil. And then he says that it's banishing the anger that will bring humility. And he says humility is the most important thing. Why will banishing anger bring humility? Because humility and anger cannot coexist. Because what banishing anger means, it means at the end of the day, shifting the focus away from ourselves. It means it's not about my feelings. It's not about just projecting who I am, right? It's not about me. So anger comes when it is about me. You hurt me. You didn't do things the way I wanted to do it. I wanted to control it and you threatened me. You offended me. You offended the way you disagreed with my perspective. I had the day planned out in a certain way and my life planned out in a certain way and it didn't happen. Anger is a direct product of egocentricity, of ego, of me, the feeling of me. That's why we get frustrated. That's why we get angry all the time, if we do. Because anger is an expression of emotion without thinking. And as we talked about many, many times, what is emotion? Emotion is me. That's where my personality lives. So every time, if I'm impulsive and instinctive, and I just respond straight from the heart without letting the head get in the way and think it through properly to understand what is right, I just go back to what I am, the way I look at it, the way I feel about it. So anger is a direct expression of emotion jumping in without thinking, and my emotion is about me, and therefore anger is all about just, I got it, I was threatened, I think this way, this is what I want to do, this is the way I want things to work out, and if they don't, there's that frustration and that incredible expression of anger. When we work, as Nachmanides says, if we work hard to banish anger, if we talk calmly, even if it's fake at the beginning. In other words, even if we want to platz, but we don't, right? We train ourselves to talk calmly. And that in itself, as we said, you know, the heart follows the actions a lot of time, right? And we train ourselves to be mindful. We train ourselves to live moment by moment. We train ourselves to defer to other people. We train ourselves to listen to other people. In other words, we train ourselves not to be impulsive, not to be reactive, but to be proactive, to think before we talk, to think before we do, to let the pause set in so that we can make a decision that is contrary often to the way I feel. But I say something, I was going to say something, but I said something else because I know that's the better thing to say, or the better thing to do, or the better way to react. I stay calm, or I try to stay calm, I relax, I do a breathing exercise, whatever the case is, even though I don't want to, because it's not about me. I learn to shift away from myself. And the shifting away from myself teaches me to be more functional. I'm able to be happy. I'm able to use my talents and my strengths better because I'm not entangled in myself the whole time. When I learn, when I train myself to move away from the me, suddenly that ability to be humble sets in. Banishing anger, says Nachmanides, brings humility. It sets in. It becomes a real thing after a while. You want to ask that?
Yeah, I just want to.
Only if you don't deal with it in the right way. In other words, let's take a simple example, right? If I'm angry with someone because I really have a conflict with them, so I train myself. So one thing is for sure. What we're saying is like this: the response can never be anger because that's just an expression of my egocentricity. It's an expression of myself. It's a dysfunctional way of dealing with it. It's ineffective, right? All of those, and it's about me. That's what it is at the end of the day. But I still have the problem. I still have the conflict. Now, sometimes I don't. Sometimes as we train ourselves to be less focused on ourselves, suddenly we become a lot less needy. Right? We train ourselves to be less needy. And if we train ourselves to be less needy, then some things don't end up being... It's not a suppression. We just see that it was nonsense to begin with. Right? I mean, if we get up in the morning, to use my example last week, and our email fails and we don't get angry, we realize later that actually the world didn't fall apart and it's fine. I don't have a deep-rooted, traumatic experience that I have to go for therapy for. That's right. It's just I need to train myself not to get so excited. That's all. That's very simple. However, not always so simple, because sometimes it comes from a very deep conflict or a very deep traumatic experience or a very deep problem that we have. So the first thing is not to get angry. The second thing is to be aware of the problem and to deal with it, but to deal with it effectively. That's why I said last week, one of the most critical strategies of managing anger is actually to learn to deal with other issues effectively, right? Which actually leads me to what I want to sort of go back to that comment that we talked about at the end of the session last week. It's a matter of what comes first. In other words, like this. It is true. That was the question you asked last week. It is true that sometimes we get angry a lot of times because we have unresolved issues, right? And sometimes it is true that we have to resolve those issues before we can learn not to lose our temper the whole time, because if we don't, we're just dealing with a symptom, we're not dealing with the cause. However, it is also true that both have to come together, because if we don't train ourselves not to lose our temper, meaning we don't train ourselves not to be focused on ourselves, if we don't train ourselves to make space within ourselves for humility to set in, as the Nachmanides says, then we remain in the world of entitlement. We remain in the world of victimhood. And as traumatic as it could have been, even if when I was a child, if I had a real issue, and a legitimate issue, an issue which I need to solve, but I need to solve it in a healthy context. I need to solve it in an effective way. I need to solve it in a way that works, that is good for me, good for the world, good for my spirituality, good for my emotional health, and good for the overall plan of a meaningful and deep life. If we remain trapped in ourselves and we say, I'm going to stop getting upset, but before I need to first resolve that issue, often what happens is people remain trapped in victimhood. Now, a victim doesn't mean that nothing bad happened. It could be a terrible thing that happened. But sometimes for us to move forward, we need to first learn the art of humility. At the same time, be aware that we have really deep issues to resolve, because without resolving it, we won't be able to really long-term and effectively deal with our anger, because it won't work. It'll keep coming back to us. So yes, we need to deal with it, but it needs to be in a context that I need to deal with it in a way that's effective. I need to deal with it in a way that I want to move on. I don't want it to trap me. Unfortunately, we find often that people are incredibly entitled and incredibly trapped in the things that happen to them. And those negative things that happen to them are legitimately bad. And they should never have happened. And it needs to be dealt with and it needs to be resolved. But it needs to be resolved in a healthy way. We cannot, and we all do this to some extent, just to, you know, it depends what the extreme is. And sometimes some people do it to an extreme where they live a life of victimhood, which is really the same thing as taking ourselves too seriously. In other words, it's about us, it's about me. If it's not about me, it doesn't necessarily translate of, I don't need to deal with it. I do need to deal with it, because I need to be a healthy person for the plan, for the mission, for the overall value of life. I need to use every part of me for the right reason, and I can't use every part of me if some parts of me have been damaged. If my emotions have been damaged from past experiences, I need to deal with that, because I need to become a healthy person. If my mind, if my consciousness, my subconsciousness, whatever it is, have been severely damaged, I need to work on that. But I need to work in that with the resilience, with the determination, finding the strength in myself that I'm going to deal with it, because I know I can overcome it. I know I can fix it. I know I can resolve it, and I know I can move forward, and I know I can continue to achieve. That's why the two things have to come together. And that's why Nachmanides doesn't write to his son that make a long list of all your past issues and deal with them and then start talking calmly and stop getting angry. He says, no, right away, my first instruction to you is talk calmly and banish anger and let humility come in. Because when all of that happens, everything else can work. When all of that happens, you'll have the combination of the two papers working well with each other. You'll understand, you'll be, you'll, what did we say? You'll, you'll, not you'll think of yourself less. No. It's thinking thinking of yourself less. That's correct, right? You won't think less of yourself, but you'll think of yourself less. Such an important line, right? And that's why those two things perhaps have to come together. Now Nachmanides continues and he says an interesting thing, and that's the next step, and we'll just spend a few minutes on that. He says, let's just go back to the. There we are. He says, on the heels of humility comes Yirat Hashem. What does that mean? First of all, what does that term Yirat Hashem mean, first of all? Right? So in the Talmud we have this expression called fear of God. I just need to clarify that. God is not scary. And he never wanted to be scary. Right? God is our Father, right? Yet we have this concept of Yirat Hashem. Often in the Talmud we have this concept of Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven or fear of God. We have a mitzvah to fear God and so on and so forth, right? So the true meaning of fear, God doesn't want us to walk around petrified of Him. He wants us to be happy. He wants us to serve Him like a child serves a father, not like a dictator who's controlling someone who's in North Korea that's scared of the next move, right? That's not what Yirat Shamayim is. Fear of heaven means deferring to God, surrendering to God. That's what it means. It means, first of all, understanding the reality of a divine existence, that it becomes something real, that God becomes something real in our life, His values, His Torah, His teachings become something real, and we treat it as something real, we treat it as a reality. Part of the human being's weakness or challenge often is that what we are very used to, our frame of reference is things we can touch and feel, because that's what we created physical people, right? Our mission, one of our roles in life as Jews who are connected to God, who believe in God, is to understand that the reality of spirituality and the reality of a divine reality is no less real, perhaps maybe more real, as the table or the chair. It doesn't have the same frame of reference. It's not expressed in time and space and feel and touch and so on, but it's very real, right? In other words, it's about incorporating into our life something that superficially is not part of our life. It's not who we are. We're physical people. Now, we're not really, because we have a soul and we have a spiritual dimension and so on and so forth, but the way we wake up in the morning, before we say Modeh Ani, which Modeh means to surrender in a very big way, we're just physical people who just have a body. We're tired, we're hungry, we follow all the physical properties of life, right? Part of our mission is to have Yirat Shamayim. Yirat means fear of God, which means surrendering, to surrender to a higher purpose, to surrender to a higher being. Says the Ramban, says Nachmanides, humility will bring to that. You know, there's a fascinating concept that we are taught, that derech eretz kadma la Torah, that good and healthy relationships with other people come before the Torah. Which is why God only gave the Torah after 2,000 years. And in the if you look in the Torah, you will find a list of long stories of various different relationships. Marriage between Yitzchak and Rivka in this week's Pasha. Yaakov and his wives, fathers and children. We read about many, many relationships until we get to what is probably the most important relationship, which is between people and God. Excuse me, the revelation on Mount Sinai. Why is that? So we are taught because we used to get yelled at this from my teachers in school all the time, the saying. You know, if we'd be naughty or disrespectful, we'd say, Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah, don't forget, don't be, you know, that well-mannered and having Derech Eretz, respect for others. It's called Derech Eretz, which is the term normally used for respect or healthy social interaction. Kadma La Torah comes before the Torah, right? But what does it actually mean? Isn't it part of Torah? What does it mean it comes before the Torah? Torah is everything. It includes respectful behavior. So what does that mean, it comes before the Torah? So the truth is, this is what it means according to the commentary, is that in order to really be connected to the Torah, in order to be connected to God, you cannot do that if you cannot have a healthy relationship with other people. Why? And this is what the Nachmanides is saying. If you can't make space for another human being, you can't make space for God either. In fact, all the more so. If you can't make space for another human being who looks like you and acts like you, and is in the same world as you, and yet you can't make space, there's not enough room for another person. I think I've told you the story before about the great Hasidic rabbi called the Tzemach Tzedek. Someone came to him and said, Rabbi, I don't know what to do. Whenever I go to the Beit Midrash, whenever I go to the synagogue in the morning, everyone's stepping on me. So Tzemach Tzedek told him, who told you to lay yourself flat over the whole floor of the thing, right? Don't spread yourself so much. No one will trample you. You know, don't take yourself so seriously. If you know, like I was saying before, there's certain people who you can see that they think that the world is really created for them. In other words, in a literal sense, right? They have to be the center of everything. So obviously, people are going to step on you. Right? So if that's the basis of all relationships. At the end of the day, the secret, the foundation, the power, the success of every good relationship means making space for another person. Yes, it has to be with love, but as we've talked about many times, respect comes before love. And that is respect. Respect is about making space for another individual. That's not you. If a person can't do that, definitely can't make space for God, who's a completely different reality. And therefore, Nachmanides says that the purpose of a human being at the end of the day is to make space for God. The purpose of a human being is to have a relationship with God. We were given a gift called the Torah, which is our moral code, which gives us the mitzvot, it gives us the values, it gives us the moral direction of how to live life in a purposeful, fulfilling and meaningful way. In order to do that, not just about commandments, it's about a relationship. When God gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai, it was considered a marriage. In fact, it says in the Talmud that God lifted up the mountain, and the commentaries say it was like a chuppah. It was a marriage between us and God. In order for that relationship to work, you have to be able to have a relationship with other people. And therefore, this is his formula. He says, you've got to talk calmly, because if you talk calmly, you will be able to deal with your anger. And when you banish your anger, you give room for the concept of humility to set in a true way. And humility means to be able to function properly, to be aware of who you are, to really know who you are, but at the same time not take up space. As I said before, to be present, but not to take up space. To make room for other people, to be humble, truly humble, not to feel a superiority to anyone else, and therefore there's plenty of space for other people. And when you're able to do that, humility, says, will result in a proper relationship with God, in Yirat Hashem. Because Nachmanides was a great sage, there's no doubt, when he wrote a letter to his son, one of his primary motivations would be for his son to live a very deep godly life. But he doesn't start that way. He says, stop being angry, or don't be angry, talk calmly, be humble, and if you're humble, what follows from there is that God will be part of your life as well. Because if you make room for other people, you can make room for God. I just want to remind everyone that next week I'm going to be away, so there won't be a class. We'll resume again in 2 weeks' time with the last few points of Nachmanides' letters. Have a great week.